Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling an institution that's, well, everywhere and nowhere, isn't it? The university. Almost everyone interacts with it or depends on it somehow.
Yeah, billions, maybe trillions globally get poured into them.
Exactly. And yet, it often feels like it's, I don't know, constantly teetering on the edge.
Mm-mm.
Is it too expensive, too political, maybe just out of touch?
It really is an enigma. I mean, how does something survive for, what, 1,000 years and still feel like it's in a perpetual state of crisis today?
That's the question.
So we're diving into the analysis offered by really two perfect guides for this,
yeah.
David Palfreyman and Paul Temple. Their book is Universities, a very short introduction. Short, but wow, it packs a punch.
Okay.
Our mission really is to pull out those core insights. Why this constant conflict? And maybe more importantly, how does the university actually manage to, you know, adapt and keep going despite all the pressures?
And right from the start, you hit this central problem, this paradox. The university is supposed to be two things that just seem fundamentally opposed.
Mm.
On one hand, you have the history, the sort of romantic image of the ivory tower, right? Dedicated to pure thought, pure knowledge. Keep it separate from messy commerce.
Right, the traditional ideal.
But then, bang, today's demand is totally different. It has to be an economic engine. Churn out those patents, make graduates job ready immediately, show a clear return on investment, like now.
Yeah, measurable outputs.
So how on earth can one place satisfy both the scholar who's just seeking truth and, say, the CEO who needs immediate results?
Yeah.
That's the tension, isn't it? That's what we need to unpack.
It really is. And, you know, the authors, Palfreyman and Temple, they're so well suited to this. What makes their perspective so powerful is how they blend these two views.
Okay, tell us about them.
Well, you've got David Palfreyman. He's a bursar, Oxford. So he's deep in the day-to-day operational reality. We're talking finance, buildings, juggling budgets, dealing with the immediate pressures of running, well, one of the oldest universities in the world.
The nuts and bolts,
yeah.
The practical side.
Exactly. Then you have Paul Temple. He's the academic researcher based at UCL. His focus is policy, governance, how different university systems compare globally, the bigger picture.
So it's not just theory. It's the person running the machine talking with the person studying the machine.
Precisely. They're explaining it from the inside out. They know where the friction really is, not just on paper, but, you know, in the budget meetings, in the committees.
And that deep understanding that leads them to this this first really big idea, right? That the university isn't just one thing.
No, definitely not. That's key. It's like it has this quadruple identity. It's trying to be four different things all at the same time under one roof.
Four things fighting for the steering wheel. Okay,
yeah.
Let's break those down. What's the first one?
First, there's that historical ideal we mentioned, the community of scholars. Think collegial, consensus-driven. It's all about the pursuit of knowledge, peer review, that kind of thing.
The classic image. Okay, number two.
Second, and this one's really gaining ground, is the corporate enterprise. This is the university run like a business. Managerial, focused on efficiency, strategic plans, hitting performance targets, market share.
Makes sense with the funding pressures. Third.
Third, it's also seen as an instrument of the state. It has to answer to public policy. Maybe deliver research for national defense or help with social mobility or train people for specific jobs the government needs filled.
Accountable to the public, or at least the government. And the last one.
And finally, it still holds onto its role as a crucible for personal development. This is the Newman idea, liberal arts, building character, helping students grow as individuals, producing critical citizens, not just, you know, skilled workers.
Wow. Okay, so the analogy they use makes perfect sense then. It's like trying to run a monastery.
Right, based on consensus.
A fast-growing tech company focused on next quarter's results.
Uh-huh.
And a government department that has to follow every new policy directive.
All out of the same building with the same people.
Yeah. It's no wonder it feels like a crisis.
Yeah.
But they also say that's its strength.
Paradoxically, yes. This inherent conflict, this constant pulling in different directions, is what forces it to adapt. It's messy, but it's also incredibly resilient because of it.
Interesting. And this messiness, it's not exactly new, is it? You look back, and these fights have been going on for centuries.
Oh, absolutely. The book touches on this history. Think about the medieval universities like Bologna or Paris. They started as basically guilds, self-governing corporations of teachers and students.
Like trade unions for scholars.
Kind of, yeah. And they had to fight tooth and nail against the church, against the local rulers, just to get some independence, some autonomy. That struggle, we see echoes of it today when universities push back against government control.
And this history also gives us these sort of foundational philosophies about what a university is for, right? These models that still clash today.
Exactly. Two really stand out. First, there's the Humboldt-Chen model, came out of 19th century Germany. The big idea here is the unity of research in teaching.
Unity? How does that work?
Well, the thinking is that students learn best not by just passively receiving information, but by actually participating in the discovery process alongside the top researchers. So the professors are researchers first and foremost, and teaching is sort of a woven into that exploration.
Okay, learning by doing research, what's the contrast?
The contrast is the Numanian model. You often associate this with places like Oxford and Cambridge historically. Here, the emphasis is much more on the liberal arts, cultivating the mind, producing well-rounded citizens with critical thinking skills.
Less about the specific research, more about the person.
Yeah, less focus on immediate job skills or groundbreaking research output, and more on forming character, intellectual discipline, that kind of holistic development.
And the difference for someone choosing where to go, I mean, that's huge, isn't it?
It's massive. If you go to a place that leans heavily Humboldtian, you might find the star professors are, well, mostly focused on their research. Your learning might be geared towards getting involved in that cutting edge stuff.
Right.
But if you choose a place that leans more Numanian, you're probably signing up for more direct teaching focus, maybe smaller classes, more emphasis on discussion and critical thinking, potentially less on hyper-specialization right away.
So most universities today are probably a mix.
Oh, absolutely. They're all hybrids now.
Okay.
But understanding which way an institution tilts, what its underlying philosophy kind of favors, that's really crucial for finding the right fit for you.
That makes sense.
Okay.
Okay, so you have this historical foundation, these competing ideas baked in from the start, and then, bam, after World War II, things really start to shift dramatically.
Yeah, seismic shifts.
We need to talk about this idea of the student changing from being seen as like an apprentice scholar in those older models.
Right.
To becoming, well, what they often feel like today, a consumer. How did that happen?
It's really driven by two massive forces hitting at roughly the same time, massification and marketization.
Okay, massification first. What's that?
Massification is simply the huge expansion of higher education. It went from being something for a tiny elite, maybe 5% of the population in some countries, to being seen as a necessity for like 50% or more. The sheer scale just exploded.
So way more people going to university than ever before.
Way more. And the old systems, the old ways of doing things, they just couldn't cope with those numbers.
Which leads to?
Marketization.
Exactly. That's where marketization steps in. The authors argue pretty forcefully, I think, that applying business principles to manage this massive growth, basically, starting to treat education like a product or a service you buy, that's the single biggest, most transformative change in modern universities.
Treating education like a product?
Yeah.
How does that play out? Well, it affects almost everything. Tuition fees, obviously. But also how courses are designed, how universities advertise, the kind of support services they offer.
So if the student is a consumer, the university has to compete for their business.
Precisely. You have to attract them, keep them happy. So universities become much more responsive to student demands about, say, the quality of the dorms, the gym facilities, career counseling, job placement rates.
Okay, that sounds good. In a way, more responsive, more accountable to the students?
It can be, yeah. That's the potential upside. Responsiveness is generally good. But the authors point out some pretty serious drawbacks to this consumer model.
Like what? What are the risks?
Well, the big one is the pressure for customer satisfaction. If your success is measured by keeping students happy, does that lead to things like grade inflation? Are standards lowered just to keep the customer satisfied and the completion rates high?
I see.
And then there's the pressure on the curriculum itself. Do faculty feel pushed to make courses more entertaining or immediately relevant to a job, maybe at the expense of teaching deeper, more fundamental knowledge that takes longer to pay off?
So the focus shifts from how do we best educate this person for the long term to how do we package and sell this degree most effectively right now? It's a subtle shift, but it can have really profound consequences for what education actually means.
And that focus on the market, on efficiency, that ties directly into how universities are run, doesn't it? The whole governance question. Who's actually in charge?
Absolutely. Inside the university, you see this constant tug of war between two different styles of running the place.
Which are?
On one side, you have the traditional collegial model. Power rests with the faculty, usually through lots of committees. Decisions get made, but often slowly, deliberately, needing broad consensus.
The professors run the show, basically.
Kinda, yeah. Or at least have a very strong say. But pushing against that is the modern trend. Managerialism.
Managerialism. Sounds more corporate. It is. Think corporate-style leadership. Top-down decisions made by professional administrators, presidents, vice chancellors, provosts, deans. The focus is on efficiency, strategy, nimble responses to the market.
And managerialism is winning out.
It seems to be gaining ground almost everywhere. And a big reason for that, the authors argue, is the change in funding.
Follow the money.
Always. The huge global trend is less public funding. Governments are reducing the share they contribute through direct grants.
So universities have to find the money elsewhere.
They have to become much more entrepreneurial. That means relying more heavily on student tuition fees, obviously, but also trying to commercialize research, license patents, seek corporate partnerships, attract international students paying higher fees, get donations.
Okay, so the sticker shock people feel about tuition fees, it's not just random. It's tied to this bigger shift away from public funding.
It's directly linked. It's basically a policy choice, conscious or not, to shift the cost burden from the state or the taxpayer onto the individual student and their family. And this hunk for money, it inevitably impacts the university's freedom, its autonomy.
Oh, so?
Because whoever pays the piper calls the tune, right? When governments still provide funds, or when big private donors or corporations step in, they often attach strings. They impose performance metrics.
Like what kind of metrics?
Oh, things like graduation rates, how quickly graduates get jobs in certain fields, the number of research papers published in top journals, citation counts, income generated from patents.
The accountability agenda.
Exactly. And while accountability sounds good, it can mean the university has less freedom to define its own mission, to pursue knowledge that doesn't have an immediate payoff, or to support fields that aren't currently hot or commercially viable.
And this pressure, this accountability, it really ramps up with the whole global competition thing, right?
Yeah.
The race to be world class.
Oh, massively. Palfreyman and Temple are quite critical of this obsession, especially how it's driven by international league tables and rankings.
Rankings. Everyone talks about the rankings. What's their take?
Well, their critique is pretty sharp. They argue that while competition can be good, these global rankings tend to promote a very specific, very narrow definition of what excellence means. And it's usually an Anglo-American model.
How so? What makes it narrow?
Because the metrics they use, things like research funding, publication counts in certain journals, international reputation surveys, they heavily favor large, old, wealthy English-speaking universities, institutions that already have a global brand and lots of resources.
But hang on, is it good if everyone tries to meet those high standards? Doesn't that lift all boats?
That's the argument, but the authors see a real danger. Homogenization.
Homogenization, meaning everyone becomes the same.
Pretty much. It encourages universities with very different strengths and local missions, maybe a regional college focused on teacher training, or a small liberal arts school great at undergraduate teaching, to basically abandon what makes them unique.
Why would they do that?
To chase the metrics. They divert resources away from their core mission, maybe away from teaching, towards boosting research output in specific fields, hiring star researchers who might not be great teachers, all just to climb a few spots on a global list.
So it creates this kind of conformity trap.
That's a good way to put it. They sacrifice their unique identity to try and fit this single, narrow, world-class mold, which might not even be appropriate for their students or their region. The world actually needs lots of different kinds of universities, but the rankings push towards just one model.
Okay, that's a really powerful critique. So let's bring it back to the listener. What are the practical takeaways from all this? If you're trying to navigate this complex world as a student or a parent, or just someone who cares about education.
Well, for anyone choosing a university, the big message is look beyond that single ranking number. It doesn't tell the whole story. Use the framework from the book. Ask yourself, what's the feel of this place? Is it leaning more Humboldtian? Is the focus on getting you involved in research early?
Or is it more Newmanian?
Right. Is the emphasis on broad critical thinking, small seminars, developing you as a whole person? Knowing that underlying identity, or at least the tilt, can help you find a much better personal fit than just chasing prestige. It helps manage your expectations, too.
That makes sense. And what about for us as citizens?
I think the key insight is to see the university not just as a place that provides job training, but as a vital public good, a long-term investment. We need to understand that the crazy tuition fees and student debt aren't happening in a vacuum. They're directly connected to decades of declining public investment.
So arguing for better public funding isn't just about lower costs. It's about what?
It's about investing in the intellectual foundation of society. It's about supporting the kind of long-term inquiry and critical thinking that doesn't always have an immediate market value. There's a great line capturing this. Universities create value that markets cannot measure and governments cannot mandate.
Mm. Value that markets cannot measure and governments cannot mandate.
Mm.
That really sticks with you. It captures that tension perfectly.
It does.
You know, the biggest thing I'm taking away from this is that the university's resilience, its ability to survive for so long, maybe comes from these conflicts, not despite them.
Yeah, I think that's right.
It's this constant battle, ivory tower versus engine, scholar versus manager, state versus autonomy, that keeps it in this, like, dynamic balance. It's messy, it's unstable, but that's what forces it to keep changing, keep adapting. It keeps it relevant.
It's a battleground, but maybe the battle itself is what generates the energy. And perhaps the final thought to leave folks with, building on that homogenization point. The real challenge going forward, maybe the biggest one, is ensuring that institutional diversity survives this global push for conformity. While we need those world-class research hubs, we also desperately need all the other kinds of institutions, too.
The teaching colleges, the regional universities, the specialized schools.
Exactly. We need that whole ecosystem. A truly knowledgeable society needs many kinds of universities serving many different needs. Resisting the pressure to make them all look the same might be the most important struggle ahead.
A really crucial point to end on. We need the whole ecosystem, not just the single species the rankings favor.
Well put.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.